welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We also stream live at those times at richarddugan.com, and we also archive these programs so that if you want to listen to them again, you just go to the radio shows page at richarddugan.com, and you'll also be able to go to the website of our guests, including today's guest, to find out more about what we talked about in these interviews. And a reminder that I have no clue as to how long this interview is going to go. It may last as long as the radio broadcast, but it could go, heck, depending upon my guest, it could go an hour and a half for all I know. And that's why it's important for you to go to the website and listen to the entire interview, including what I like to call the afterview, which is beyond the 50-minute mark in the program, so that you can hear everything that our guest has to share with us here on the program. And today is going to be no exception. We're going to communicate with our guest in a very real way, hopefully consciously. Well, that's a very good reason for that, because she's the author of Conscious Communications, a step-by-step guide to harnessing. I like that. We'll find out what kind of harness she's talking about. The power of your words to change your mind, your choices, and your life. Right up our alley. And Mary Shores, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Dr. D, it is absolutely my pleasure to be here. I'm so excited.
Well, I'll tell you, when we start talking about communicating, there's a running joke within the broadcast industry that the worst level of communication is within the broadcast community. Although my boss presently and I have a very good communication, and we also have wonderful redundancies to catch anything that the other might miss, to have another set of eyes on whatever's going on. And in a manner of speaking, as individuals who are spiritual beings, if this is a philosophy or a construct that you hold, spiritual beings that are having a human experience, we kind of have that with our intuition. But we have to be conscious. We have to be awake. And we're going to talk about what that means as well. You are also rather noted in one respect, in that you're the founder and CEO of a multi-million dollar business, one of the most unique collection agencies in the country. Am I correct? A collection agency is just that, what it means? If I owe money and the company hasn't been able to collect from me, they may call you and say, hey, would you call this knucklehead and get our money?
That's absolutely right.
But I would venture you probably approach it from a little different perspective, because when I used to, and we've all been there, when I used to have problems making the payments on something, and a lot of times I would just want to disconnect. It's, okay, if I don't talk to them, they won't bother me. And I'll turn the bell on my phone off so that I'll never hear it ring, and so forth and so on. However, I've learned over the years that it's a heck of a lot better to communicate with these folks and in a civil tone. You do not get angry at them. You borrowed the money and you agreed to pay it back. And when you deal with them on that level, you kind of take the wind out of their sails. This is the old style. And they're usually more likely to negotiate with you for something that's mutually beneficial. Can you give us a synopsis, if you will, of how your agency happens to work in dealing with folks in this regard?
Well, it sounds like what you're describing is where the consumer is empowering themselves to be brave enough to call up the agency and, you know, start a negotiations process. And what my mission is that I want to make people feel good about paying their debt, because having a debt is such a psychological burden. And, you know, you've said in the past you've been in that position, so you know that it just is a burden that kind of, it can create a brick wall between you and your dreams. And I feel like as my role as a debt collector, I want to make people feel good about the fact that they're paying it, mm-hmm. instead of feeling shame for having a debt. And many collection agencies, I mean, like almost all of them, really will use these tactics of shame and intimidation and threats in order to collect a debt. And I just feel like we're at a time in history where that's not going to motivate someone. You know, we really want to give people hope. We want to let them know that these problems that they're having are temporary and that there is a light on the other side, and really focus on those people who want to get out of debt and do what we can to help them.
Well, I couldn't agree with that philosophy, if you will, more than anything, because it is not just a debilitating to one's dreams. All of your relationships, from the more intimate with your partner and your kids, if you have them, on up, is affected because your emotions. You're in fear 99% of the time, and you feel like you don't know what to do. You don't have a choice. And really, and this was interesting, and I relate this only because I think that it applies. When I was served with divorce papers, and hopefully that is the only divorce I ever have, I was served on May 1st of 1998. I was actually able to make a joke on that day, by saying, this gives a whole new meaning to the phrase Mayday. I was an emotional basket case for a month, for the entire month of May. When June 1st kicked around, and I don't know if it had anything to do with star transitions or astrological movement and this and that and the other, all I know was, in spite of the fact that I was being made to feel 100% responsible for where I was, and this was more not so much responsible, but I was to blame for what I was in, because this is what her attorney was telling me. This is your fault, blah, 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 blah. June 1st rolled around, and then I realized, yes, I am responsible. However, I'm not the only one. There was another person involved in this transaction, if you will, or this contract. Well, the same thing is true with this issue of debt. Now, I don't know about you, but back in the 70s, and I was still in grade school and high school in the 70s, I was watching the news, not really actively, but I kept hearing people from the government perspective saying how great debt was, that debt was a good thing. And this was more from a governmental standpoint. Maybe it was because we didn't have a huge national debt at that time. I don't know. All I know is I kept hearing that, and I thought, okay, this is good. And then, of course, I get into my 20s in the 80s, and I have it. And it didn't feel real good. And I'm wondering, how is that good? I don't understand. Can you give us maybe some information from your perspective in terms of how you deal with, and I want, do you refer to them as debtors, or is there another term of a more positive nature, if you will, a more affirming nature that you use?
The correct term is consumers.
Okay. That's a rather neutral term, which is good. Do you deal with consumers directly, not just through the collection agency, but maybe through workshops and seminars, including maybe, because I know you have a blog as well, to help them to understand that they aren't to blame. It's not their fault, but that they are responsible.
Well, I can tell you a story. So, and this kind of goes, is going to cover like what you're talking about, also cover our mindset and our perception of debt and how we sort of make the creditor the bad guy. So, a friend of mine called me up a couple of years ago. She said, "You know, I need, this happens to me often, I need some advice because many times they're trying to increase their credit score." Now, of course, they want to increase their credit score without paying any of the debt that lowered their credit score. So she starts with their story, and like your show's all about story, right? So this is perfect. She starts with their story, and it looks kind of like this. "The evil big bad credit card companies have destroyed my credit, and no matter what I do, I'm not going to be able to get away." And she was really projecting this concept that it was the credit card company's fault that she was in all this debt. And I said, "Wait a minute, Gail. You know, they didn't make you charge things to that card." And she said, "Yeah, but they charge these like ridiculous interest rates and fees and stuff." And I said, "Right, because you know what? You have to pay the fees for all the and cover all of the people that didn't pay." And she said, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "Well, I said they have to charge enough interest so that their risk is covered, meaning that all of these people who charge $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 and never ever pay it back, they have to make enough money off of the people who do pay it back in order to cover their losses." And this would be true of any company that extends credit. So I think that, another thing would be, let's talk about the medical industry. It's always like the big bad doctors or the big bad insurance company. When we don't look at it as what a gift it is that we have top-notch medical care for very reasonable out-of-pocket costs. I mean, even with insurance in the state that it's in today, you could pretty much have a surgery with all kinds of aftercare included, and maybe even some medical equipment, and your out-of-pocket costs could range from $1,500 to $3,000. And in my book, my health is an investment, and that's not a huge investment to make to have good health or to get something fixed. But so many times I'll talk to people and they won't have a surgery because they know it's going to cost them $1,500, and their belief is that they shouldn't have to pay for it. But yet that same person is driving a Mercedes.
Yeah. They want the luxury items without the luxury expense.
Right. So they see their medical care as something that almost like they shouldn't have to spend their own personal out-of-pocket money on. And this really goes in my book that I've just written, Conscious Communications. It's not at all about debt. So I like to kind of switch on to the book is really about your mindset and how to connect to the things that are in your we all have these like potentials that we could live up to. And we have equal potential to say, become very, very successful in whatever your field is. Like I would like to become a best-selling author, but I also have the potential of failing miserably. And the book is all about how to choose your words, your thoughts, and your actions to connect you to the life that you want and sort of help you pivot out of a life of just chaos after chaos.
It sounds like you read a chapter of the book I'm writing. Because
It,
that's a very phrase of one of the chapter titles, as a matter of fact. But
I love it.
be that as it may. No, you're absolutely right. And this is one of the things that I noticed just in the last few years nationally in this country, that there were individuals, and they're still around in the public eye today, who basically they state a very salient point. They don't state it real saliently, but the point is definitely valid. But they make us, those who are supposedly affected by this particular point, they make us out to be the victim. And I'm thinking, oh, I get the point that you're making, but I'm not a victim. I refuse to take that role anymore. And a lot of people, and by the way, that was a very good transition from debt to conscious communication. The whole thing of going back to the issue of finance and debt and so forth, and again, this is in a lot of different areas of our lives, we are made to think we are the victim. When I was going through my divorce, I was made to feel like I was responsible, and it was my fault. I was being, feeling that victimization, if you will. Maybe that's the way for me to phrase that. What are some of the early steps? Because obviously with this program, we want to teach people, we want to share with people ideas and concepts, philosophies that will help them to thrive. And so where do you begin, say, with an individual to inspire them to create new ways of thinking and identifying and achieving their goals, and then taking action to create truly meaningful results? How do you do that? Where do you begin?
Well, I think a great entry point is to start at the end.
Oh, really? Okay.
Asking yourself, what do you really want? Getting clear and completely laser focused on what is your desire in this decade, in this week, in this month, in this lifetime? What is it that you really want? And once you can identify that, so it's kind of like a step one. And then step two is to really ask yourself, now, what am I willing to give in order to achieve that result? Because especially in some of the directions where some belief systems are going, we have this thought process where we can manifest something out of thin air just by, just by manifesting it. And while there's some truth that you could attract things to you, it's truly the actions you're going to take, what you're focused on, your thoughts, and the words you say that are doing the work of attracting to you or creating a connection to what you want or driving more of a disconnection. And I'm really a big proponent of brain science, neuroscience in general, to help understand why these things are true. Like, just through your neural networks, your neural pathways, understand how synapses work to sort of create and construct this reality around us. And that every little choice you make certainly counts towards the end result. And also, like, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that one of the sciences that used to be prevalent was that for those who imbibed in alcohol, that it killed off brain cells, never to be never to be brought back again. Well, in the last 20, 15 or 20 years, science has said, no, that is not true. Brain cells are constantly being created because the human body over the period of 7 years completely regenerates itself, and the brain is part of the human body. I always thought that was kind of a strange thing, which leads into a whole nother area. But when you are talking about these pathways that are currently mapped in the way that they are, you're now talking about, in a manner of speaking, remapping those pathways, aren't you?
Correct. And what you mentioned is called epigenetics and like or neurogenesis. So neurogenesis is creating new brain cells. Now, I just want to state publicly that alcohol does kill your brain cells.
Oh, no, I don't deny that. Don't deny that.
Okay. So, but the thing is, we are creating new ones, but and we're regenerating them. But the ones you killed in the alcohol, those are never coming back.
Right. Oh, no,
So
absolutely.
those are gone forever, but you can regenerate them, and there's lots and lots of ways you can do that. I mean, certainly, and even there's just so much information coming out at a very fast rate about neurology that is mind blowing. Like, for example, I watched an interview with a world famous, world renowned neuroscientist who said that the research is showing that just by being in proximity with another person, that your brain waves synchronize together.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and so what that means is if you have somebody that has achieved something that you want, let's say, you want to write a book, then you go hang out with other people who've written a book, and then what you find is your brain, almost like through osmosis, is wiring itself to their brain or synchronizing to their brain. And the more that you do that, the more that you hang around with people who have the mindset that you want versus hanging around people who are always like the glass is half full, you can start to see changes and pivots in your life and just, like the veil sort of beginning to lift. And so, yes, it's very true. We are constantly creating neurogenesis, creating new brain cells, and you can increase that just by reading, by taking certain supplements. There's just all kinds of fun things going on.
I know that there was a video game that I used to play years ago. I think it was when I had either a 2 or 386 or something like that. Of course, we're not talking back the mid-90s. It was called Heaven and Hell. That was the name of it. And you basically went from one puzzle to the next. And as you advanced from one level to the next, the puzzles changed, whether it was sliding tiles, whether it was connecting dots to make a particular pattern. I mean, just a myriad of different things. And I absolutely loved it. And of course, one of the things, the triggers that kind of kept you going was that every time you succeeded in solving that puzzle, you received a philosophical passage. And basically, you were working your way toward, Oh, it was some mythical heaven. I can't remember the name of it now off the top of my head. But it was really a lot of fun. And I thought, gee, and I've thought about that. And I know that there are some websites that actually provide this kind of service. But my only concern, and this is unfortunately the exposure I've had to too many people who are conspiracy theorists, is, well, okay, these puzzles or these tests or these quizzes that they're putting up there to help you to sort of strengthen your brain power, rewrite the pathways and so forth, do they have a hidden agenda? You know, are they trying to program you going in? I mean, you get a little crazy after a while starting to think of that. But I remember years ago reading a book about how we, brain power, how to utilize the other 90%. It was basically claiming that we're only using 10%. Do you believe that that's the case, that it's only 10?
I believe we have no clue what's going on up there. I believe that, I mean, this percentage changes every time we have the conversation, right?
I love that.
When I was growing up, it was 3%. So here's what I think, okay? Here's what I think. The brain, and I'm going to demonstrate why. The brain is a miraculous, powerful machine that is so powerful beyond anything that we can imagine. And that I don't know what percentage of our brain that we're using, but let's just talk for a minute about, you know, the guy in England that can recite 20,000 digits of pi.
Yes.
You know, 3.1514.
Mm-hmm.
My son can do like 50 numbers. I could do 3.14.
Okay. I can say pie.
You can say pie.
Okay. I can say pie.
And you can probably eat pie.
I can. I've got apple pie in the fridge right now.
Perfect. Okay. So we're on the same page. We know what pie is. Okay. So here's the thing. But you know that guy I'm talking about?
Yes.
He's been on those superhuman shows.
I've seen them. Yes.
So he has a thing called synesthesia. And synesthesia means that one part of his brain has a neural pathway to another part of his brain that the rest of us do not have. And his specifically is that he sees numbers as colors.
Hello.
Hello.
I do too.
No way.
Yes.
We have to get you reciting pi. So this is a very rare thing that happens. Some people might be able to taste a color. Some people might be able to hear a number or hear a taste. Mm-hmm. So their senses are sort of wired together differently. When they were a fetus, so we actually all start off with these connections, because, you know, when you're a fetus or when you're a zygote or whatever, you're mm-hmm. like one cell. Mm-hmm. And the cells continue to separate and separate according to your genetic code. So what's supposed to happen is these like predetermined neural networks, which is like the instincts that we're born with. But in this particular person's, there was some miswiring going on. So what that tells me is that each and every one of us has that same potential in our brain, but it's the way our particular anatomy is wired that either gives us that ability or doesn't give that ability. Like a person who's 3 years old who can play the piano like a savant, they've got something going on in their mind that we all have it there. And it's just only as our fetus develops that we begin to lose these connections. And so as science progresses, we might be able to just figure out how to wire these things back together. And they're actually doing these experiments at like Cambridge, where by studying autism, they can say, ask an adult human a math trick problem. And the person cannot answer the question, but they ask, say, a person who has Asperger's, and the person with Asperger's can answer the question instantly. Mm-hmm. And I understand my son has Asperger's, so he would be able to do something like this. Well, they can put a brain stimulation cap on me, who could never answer a math question, but at least I know what pi is. They could put that brain stimulator cap on me, turn it on, and then all of a sudden, without any training whatsoever, I would be also able to answer the math question.
Well, you use the term wired abnormally when you referred to, for example, the gentleman with synesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
Terminology
would be either you're neurotypical. So neurotypical means like kind of wired the way everybody else is, and then, I forget the other.
Well,
the ones with Asperger's would be considered non-neurotypical.
Okay, but I would suppose, that's not the word I want. Doggone it. I can't think of the word I want. I would put forth this concept. They're not miswired. Everybody else is. And these people are coming through wired the way we're supposed to be wired, because we are all supposed to have these capabilities. I hear this time and time again on different interview programs that I do with my different guests, especially when it comes to intuition, when it comes to the concept of telepathy, being able to communicate mind to mind without words and so forth and so forth. That's supposed to be the norm, and that it's possible that at one time it was the norm, but that due to our supposed advancing civilization over the thousands and thousands of years we've been here, that what's become the norm is the miswiring, that it's one in a thousand, or I don't know what the statistics are, miswired, or rather the ones that the one in a thousand is the one that is wired correctly, or at least with those pathways written. But you also raised another interesting point, and I've been kind of juggling around in my mind with this concept. You know, you talk about how we begin as a single cell, and then it divides and divides and divides and divides until the genetic code kicks in. And I've often wondered about that in terms of how when a baby is born, family and friends will look at that infant, and they will look at it and they will start making certain comments, such as, oh, well, Billy has Uncle Bill's nose and Aunt Jean's eyebrows. And then, of course, as he starts to talk and make sounds and so forth, oh, he's got, Aunt Flo's laugh and on and on and on and on. And then as he progresses through school and starts to show aptitude in particular areas, those aptitudes are attributed to other relatives. Oh, well, so-and-so was, interested in that particular pursuit and career, what have you. And then I take it to the next level and say, well, what about spiritual attributes? Especially when it comes to, say, I considered an attribute of a spiritual nature, our intuition. Now, you said that when we're in the same, sometimes when we're in the same room with someone, we will sometimes pick up on, I'll use the term electromagnetic pulses coming from their brain that go to our brain and vice versa, to where we're kind of in sync, where there are people who, sometimes when they're together, they will complete the other's sentences, or they'll be on what we term the same page, and they don't even realize that they're in concert in that regard. And so I wonder if the same thing isn't true with our intuition in this regard. Do you think that the brain has anything to do with our intuition as far as these pathways we're talking about?
Well, intuition from a scientific perspective, I would explain it that it's partially the brain. It's also our cells have a certain bit of receptor ability, and also the chemicals that are running through our body. So here's an example. You know how a dog or an animal can smell fear?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what they're doing is they can sense, or a dog can sort of intuitively know when a person that is approaching is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And the dog might start to show its teeth or have like a certain reaction. So the dog is an organic being. We humans are organic beings. The dog can sense through all of its, like, its senses, its nose, its hearing, its whiskers, if it has whiskers. Dogs don't have whiskers, cats do. But they sense this. And what they're doing is they're sensing the percentage of aggressive chemicals in the person. So they can sense that someone has fear chemicals or adrenaline, cortisol, stress chemicals. They can sense when the person is friendly, and that dogs have very good intuition like that. Well, human beings have exactly the same intuition, but we cover it up because we're covering up so many of our senses because we have loud equipment, machineries, computers, ringing telephones, like you said, electromagnetic, whatever. I mean, I'm just seeing about these water meters. I don't know what's going on with those, but cell phones, radiation, perfumes, like the things that we put on our body, perfumes, soaps, things that are inorganic that are clogging up our ability to be in touch with our senses, as well as we're not taught how to use our brains, our bodies, and our intuition from a young age. We're taught how to do things like learn history according to the way our government wants us to know history. We're taught to, you know, learn religious practices based on whatever school you go to, the way that you want to learn it. But really, if we just sort of had a different school model, like the one Rudolf Steiner wanted, where we're more taught to use the power of our brain and we're taught to use our senses, because every good entrepreneur will tell you, always follow your gut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a science fiction character that I have talked about numerous times on this program in relation to the connectedness that we have. And I don't think that the creator of this science fiction story, if you will, necessarily intended it to be taken this way, but my observations were pretty clear that, wow, that's kind of the way we're all connected together. The character happens to be a Star Trek character from the Next Generation series, and it's the Borg. The Borg's made up of individuals. Each individual carries out a different task, but they're all connected. They're all getting messages, different messages, but all towards the big picture, as it were. Now, we may never see the big picture, but it's when we are, and this is kind of going towards the concept that you've used in the title of your book, Conscious Communications, that when we are aware and awake, as the term goes, that we're going to get those impressions time and time and time again. I've had them many times throughout my life. And you talk about the gut feeling. Well, it's the same thing, where I'm being told, in quotes, you need to make a right turn. I was bicycling at the time. Make a right turn here, go up one block, and then make a left and continue on your way. And I didn't listen, and I went a half mile straight. The impression would not go away. That it wasn't a sick feeling. It was just, it wouldn't go away. And I turned around. I literally turned around, and I went back, and I took the path that I was told to take, and then continued on my way. I don't know why. I don't know if I avoided an accident or what the deal was, or if it was a test to see if I would listen and follow these promptings of my intuition. But it seems to me that there is a greater connectedness than even we are really aware of. Can you expound at all on that higher level of connectedness that we share?
Do you mean connected with each other?
Yes, literally connected with each other as well as with...
like a superconscious being?
Yes.
So, I mean, if you look at an ant colony, it's very clear that there's an intelligence driving their different roles, or a beehive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very... but as humans, they are doing studies that show that we collectively also have a consciousness. And there's a very famous study. It's called the 100th monkey effect. Have mm-hmm. you heard of this?
I have.
So the 100th monkey effect, for the listeners, is a really fascinating case of these monkeys that were on the beach in Japan. And the monkeys were given sweet potatoes to eat. And some of the younger monkeys didn't like eating the sweet potatoes when the potatoes were covered with sand. So they began to wash the sweet potatoes before they ate them. And then they taught their mothers how to wash the sweet potatoes. And little by little, more and more of the monkeys just started repeating this process of washing the potatoes. Well, what happened, and this is sort of goes into the consciousness, collective consciousness that you're discussing, is that the monkeys on the other island, who had no access to the monkeys eating this, you know, washing the potatoes, simultaneously began to wash their sweet potatoes when the original monkeys hit a certain critical mass number. And they called this the 100th monkey. Now, it wasn't exactly 100 monkeys, but when enough of their consciousness was washing the potatoes, the monkeys on the other island began mimicking that behavior without anyone ever teaching them how to do it. So it's super fascinating. They've repeated this experiment with humans by putting humans on one continent, showing them a puzzle on a television program. And then they and no one could solve it. Like a certain small percentage of people could solve the puzzle. And then they did the same test on another in another country on another continent. But in this case, they gave the people the answer. And then once they gave the people the answer on the second test, the original people were now able to solve the problem. It's really fascinating.
Wow.
So it's
Yeah. That is very cool. That is very cool. And again, it continues to reinforce that whole aspect that that we affect other people. I've always loved the last 15 or 20 years coming up with the old wives' tales, and then seeing how they're not true anymore. For example, sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you. Not true. If you allow them to affect you to enter in, and we're going to get into that as well here in the second half of our program, they can have an impact. At least that's been my experience with people around me. But also another one that I find interesting is that, and I've heard this many times, you can't change other people. Not true. You can't do it consciously and with intent. I'm going to change that person. But when you change yourself, you change that other person because that person is either going to want to get closer to you because of the changes you've made, or they're going to want to get as far away from you as is humanly possible because they don't want to have anything to do with the changes that you've just instituted in your life. Your thoughts on that particular aspect before we go to break?
Well, and I think there's also to add to what you've said, there's a ripple effect. I mean, so just by smiling at someone in the grocery store, you don't know the impact of just your facial expression could have a positive impact on them to where they walk away to their next interaction somewhat changed versus if you were to say, tell someone off at the gas station. You don't know what you've triggered in them to where when they go off to their next interaction, are they going to take that out on the next person?
Yeah. I often talk with people who are frustrated with their jobs and they don't like what they're doing, and they work with people every day, different people, whether it's especially in the medical field, for example. And I say, well, yeah, but see, what you don't understand is the impact you have. This person is very good disposition, usually very positive and happy person, but they really are frustrated with where they're at and everything. And I said, but you have a businessman who maybe woke up on the wrong side of the bed, but he's got a morning appointment at your physician's facility. He comes in and he experiences you with a positive, upbeat attitude, and he goes through the exam or whatever the procedure is, and so forth. And you've been able to sort of, be around him and give him that energy. He's going to a meeting after this appointment. If he were to still be from the perspective, the attitude of getting up on the wrong side of the bed, can you imagine what that meeting is going to be like? But he's experienced you. You've had an impact on him, and he's going to go to that meeting with a different mindset, and he may make different decisions than what he woke up thinking he was going to make, which could impact a couple of people, tens, hundreds, could affect thousands of people in a positive way. We just don't know. And I don't know if you've seen any of these programs that have been on over the last, I'm going to say, 10 years that show that ripple that you're talking about, that show they're focused on one particular individual, but they move around from scene to scene to other people unrelated to him directly, who, as the program progresses, have an impact on this one individual in terms of the intersecting of their paths. And when I saw that, and of course, some of these aren't even on anymore, which is unfortunate. But I just thought those were so fascinating that someone was willing to take the risk on a show like that to show how we can indirectly affect one another. And I just think that that's really cool. I also think what's very cool is what we're talking about here on the program. Our guest here on the program is Mary Shores. You can go to maryshores.com and you can get more information. She is also on Facebook and Twitter, and she's also on Instagram and YouTube. You can Google her and get more information about her, as well as the work that she's doing through this particular book that we're talking about, Conscious Communications. And we're going to continue our conversation here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you for staying with us and continuing to listen to our conversation here as we continue talking about conscious communication. It's really fascinating. It's a step-by-step guide to harnessing the power of your words to change your mind, your choices, and your life. And one of the things that, of course, not only this program, but also, as I mentioned earlier, the work that I've been working on this book for 17 years, and it's not a big. I'm not writing War and Peace. I'll tell you that right now, and I'm not trying to write the Great American Novel either. For whatever reason, I'm not finding the time. I'm not making, not finding the time. I can find the time. It's making it. To go through each chapter, of which there are only five, and complete this darn work. But it talks about choices. And you talk about that too, and how to make conscious choices. First of all, what do you mean by conscious when you're talking choices, or you're talking communication is the title of your book? What do you mean by conscious?
I mean that we all have different choices to make, and being conscious of whether or not the choice you're making in any given moment is moving you closer to or further away from what you want. So, you know, you've talked about this book that you've been writing for 17 years. That's a long time, Dr. D.
Yes, and, I know.
So, you know, if we use that as an example, if you would make a choice that every day you're going to move something in that book forward, you know, then you would complete that project a lot faster. What happens in the brain is once we begin to procrastinate, we set off a set of chemicals neurochemically in our brain that make us feel really bad. Like it makes us feel really just like a bad person because we've procrastinated. And then we search for things in our environment. So, you know, maybe you sit down to do some work and you feel stuck, like you feel stuck for whatever reason, like you don't know how, you don't know what the next line is, you know, for whatever reason. So you procrastinate, and then you go, say, search a cute kitten video on Facebook or YouTube. And then when you see the little kitty video and it like cheers you up, what happens is you get instant hits of happiness through like extra dopamine and serotonin to the brain. But then what happens like 5 hours later is you start feeling guilty because you wasted all day watching kitty videos. And it just becomes this like cycle, this like never ending cycle. But it might not be that complicated in your case. Maybe you're just not prioritizing the proper time to get the book done.
That would probably be the case. And I know that I've been working in the same place for 10 years, and I've seen a number of people come through who produce programs and so forth who've gotten their PhDs in less time than it's taken me to write this book. And I've heard of the process of having to get a PhD, and it seems pretty darn arduous by comparison to completing this particular work. But
yeah,
I also go ahead.
I would suggest that you might even have some sort of barrier belief about your ability, because sometimes we don't do something because somewhere deep down inside we don't believe that we can. And there's got to be, because if you really wanted it done, it would be done. Or, you know, there's a reason why it's not done. And exploring what that is sometimes can help you get over that. I call that barrier beliefs in my book, and they come from all different ways, but they're in your subconscious mind, so you're not always aware of them, but they do affect your ability to make choices. And so we would just be interested to hear some of the stories, like if somebody said, hey, Dr. D, how's that book coming along? You know, see what are the stories you're telling yourself about this book, because I bet it's a fascinating book.
Well, and again, it's not a big one. I mean, it when it first started out, I thought, well, this will just be a pamphlet, you know, because I created the concept when my wife was going through her cancer surgery and chemotherapy. And and this was back in 2001. And I'm sure that I could come up with all kinds of explanations. That's what as opposed to excuses. For me, they're explanations, but they're still excuses as to why I haven't finished. I mean, I've already designed the cover, and so on and so forth. I even managed to find the original flyer file that I created when she was going through this process, because it was one of those things where, you know, she needs something to focus on. She needs something to hang on to. And so I create, because I remember hearing this being done by others where somebody would print up all of these pieces of paper with something on each of these pieces of paper, and they taped them up all over the house, and they put them in the sock drawer, and they put them in the medicine cabinet, and they put them in all of these places where that individual would eventually go. Some of them were really well hidden, so they didn't find them for weeks. It's almost on the level of a couple who one of them really wants to show how much they love the other. So they're going to leave these little love notes all over the place, you know, in the underwear drawer and maybe in a pocket of a shirt or and so on and so forth. So that was the kind of the concept in that regard, to just try to keep her focused. Speaking of focus, you also, you talk about knocking off the negative talk, and of course other aspects of I refer to it as personal input. But when you make a choice, you need to start. If I'm understanding this correctly, you need to start to speak words that support and reinforce your choice?
Yeah, and I think that you have a great segue to start that conversation, because the little positive notes left all around the place are visual stimulation for that subconscious mind. Well, so are the words that we speak. So, for example, when I first started wanting to write my book, years went by and I never wrote anything, because my inner mantra was, I'm not a writer. And so it wasn't until I started going to writers' workshops, and, you know, in the very beginning of the interview, I said, what are you willing to give in order to achieve this result you want? And once I began to move things forward, started going to some writers' workshops, I was able to reprogram my thought process with my words and actually realize that I am very much a writer.
Well, we all have stories that we tell, not just ourselves, but other people. You know, we're in conversation and a subject comes up. So, well, you know what happened to me? And you tell your story. So that's really what it comes down to, is those negative stories that either we tell ourselves or that we have been told by others down through the years, especially from childhood, that keep us from fulfilling our dreams. What's your suggestion as to, shall we say, rewriting or eliminating that negative story and rewriting a positive story, if you will, or one that supports the choice that we're trying to make and achieve?
Well, so for my trick is cleanse or clog, which just really means that you look at every choice and you ask yourself, will this cleanse me or clog me? Meaning, will this choice create a connection to what I want, or will it create, or will it drive a disconnection? So for example, if I'm on a diet, and all I have to do is look at everything I put in my body and say, will this cleanse me or will this clog me? And as long as I am erring on the side of about 80% making cleansing connected choices, and that still leaves me, you know, 20% of the time I can eat my dessert, I can have that cappuccino or a milkshake and live very balanced. So the same is true in all of your relationships, in your career, in your finances, in your personal development, that, you know, just looking at your situation and saying, you know, will this cleanse me or clog me?
Hmm. I've had hires that I've brought into a station and I've trained, and I found it always fascinating that after going through the list of the job description, for example, you know, okay, great. And of course, they're willing to accept the pay. And of course, this was back in the 80s, early 90s. Minimum wage was, I don't know, $5, $6, $7 an hour at best. And then after a period of time, they would come to me and I would say, I need you to clean the restroom, okay? And because that's just what we did. We didn't have a cleaning service. You guys don't pay me enough to do this. Well, wait a minute. When you were hired, that was one of your tasks. And I used to hear these different messages coming back at me from folks who say, well, management doesn't, they don't care about us and this and all of these negative things. And then I began to see things from a different perspective, especially when it came to what I like to use the term just compensation, which sort of brings us full circle to finance of sorts and money. When I started doing these interviews back in 1980, and working for this one station, I was given the opportunity to do these interviews and put them on the air. And then I would be setting up the interviews. I would be getting review copies such as your book. I would get that. And I would get the chance to do the interview and have that experience as well. So I began to stack up not only books and CDs, but also at that time, cassette tapes of these interviews. And I began to see that I was getting even more than a fair exchange, what seemed to me was more than a fair exchange for the work that I was doing. Look what I was creating. I mean, I even brought some of those guests to this station where I'm broadcasting now into this program, Tell Me Your Story. And it's just, you know, we never know where the exchange is going to take place. And I think that that's one of the things that we need to let go of, that your employer may not pay you more money, but there are other ways in which the universe sets up that opposite, that equal, if you will, exchange, because you can't have a lopsided exchange. The universe won't allow it. You know, so it's, I think that's part of what you're talking about in terms of mindset. And then, of course, again, rewriting those pathways. Conscious Communication is the title of the book. Mary Shore is our guest. Mary, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program. And I would like to invite you, if you should be in the Santa Barbara area, love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
That would be so much fun. And I have to tell you that I can tell you've been in the industry such a long time because you've got such a great, powerful radio voice. I enjoyed talking with you so much.
Well, thank you. And I know that we're short on time. What I would like to do very quickly, I have three final questions for you. And I want to remind our listeners, maryshores.com is the website, maryshores.com. She's on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and all of those wonderful social media sites. So check it out. And before we let you go, question one of three is, who is Mary Shores?
Well, Mary Shores is definitely an innovator, a speaker, and a developmental powerhouse.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I'd really like to make a dent in the collective consciousness and in whatever way that I can. I really believe in being a humanity plus company by doing something to leave the human race better than where I found it.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
I think that that's a big question. So many things. I think my life's purpose is being a mother and raising children that are also going to be humanity plus individuals. But I also think that my role is to help free sort of a karmic debt situation that's going on in our country right now.
And finally, I love this quote that you have in the book, very short one. It is the unseen and the spiritual in people that determines the outward and the actual. And I think that that's absolutely true from Oswald Chambers. And again, Mary Shores, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. D.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.